Tired of blogs?
Me too. Moby Lives Radio starts now. From the intergalactic headquarters of Melville House Publishing in Hoboken, New Jersey, aka the Left Bank of New York City, it's Moby Lives Radio.
Greetings, Earthlings. It's the first day of December, 2005. I'm Dennis Johnson, and on today's show, we'll be talking to author James Marcus. He was one of the very first employees of Amazon.com. He wrote a book about the experience, and he sold that book on Amazon.com. We'll also be launching a new series in which Moby Lives Radio's Becky Kramer interviews the various foreign sub-agents for Melville House Books to find out what people are reading in their neck of the woods. And Moby Lives Radio's Canada correspondent George Murray files a report on what's going on in the Great White Way. But first, here's some news from the book world. Ill health has forced Harold Pinter to cancel all public appearances linked to his Nobel Prize for Literature, according to a statement released yesterday by the Nobel Foundation. Pinter had already pulled out of the award ceremony and banquet, but had been due in Stockholm to give the traditional Nobel Literature lecture. But according to the Foundation's statement, quote, his doctors have forbidden him to travel at this time, close quote. Instead, a speech pre-recorded by Pinter will be shown on a big screen, and his publisher, Stephen Page of Faber & Faber, will accept the award on Pinter's behalf at the December 10th award ceremony. Two economists from the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston have called the research for a key chapter of the mega-selling book Freakonomics flawed, according to a Wall Street Journal story. The charges concern the book's most controversial chapter, Where Have All the Criminals Gone?, in which authors Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner used statistics to argue that legalized abortion in the 1970s reduced crime rates later on. The economists say that the chapter is missing a key mathematical formulation, making it more difficult to account for other factors that would influence crime rates. They say, quote, there are no statistical grounds for believing that the hypothetical youths who were aborted as fetuses would have been more likely to commit crimes had they reached maturity than the actual youths who developed from fetuses and carried to term. Author Levitt has acknowledged the missing formula, but he downplayed its importance. Freakonomics, meanwhile, has sold 584,000 copies, according to the most recent Nielsen BookScan numbers. Elsewhere, months after it was pulled, the original cover for Thomas Friedman's best-selling The World is Flat is the subject of a copyright infringement lawsuit. This is according to a report from Editor and Publisher magazine. Friedman and his publisher Farrar Straus Giroux are being sued by artist Ed Miracle, whose painting of two ships about to sail off the edge of the world was on the original cover. Friedman had seen the picture on a poster, recommended it to his publisher, and the publisher had obtained permission from the owner of the poster. Miracle says, however, that he retained the copyright and is reportedly investigating suing FSG and Friedman in England as well as here in the U.S. No word, however, on how much Miracle is seeking. Historic audio recordings of poets including Robert Browning, Alfred Lord Tennyson, and Rudyard Kipling giving readings of their work are among the works featured on a new online archive that is the brainchild of British poet laureate Andrew Motion. According to a Reuters Wire story, poetryarchive.org, which Motion has been organizing since 1999, is inspired by the many poets whose voices were never recorded, such as Thomas Hardy and D.H. Lawrence, even though they lived after the invention of sound recording. Motion says the aim of the site is to make sure that doesn't happen with today's poets, And so the site also features readings by Harold Pinter, Seamus Heaney, Margaret Atwood, and Andrew Motion. And finally, producers of the animated television show The Simpsons, which gathered attention last year when reclusive author Thomas Pynchon appeared on the show, are planning an episode featuring several more major American writers, according to a Los Angeles Times story. The Times reports an upcoming episode in which Mo the Bartender is discovered to be a beatnik poet. And eventually, Tom Wolfe, Jonathan Franzen, Michael Chabon, and Gore Vidal appear on the show. Sandra Dykstra, an agent for writer Amy Tan, who also appeared on the show last year, explains it's an important accomplishment for the writers in question because, quote, "The Simpsons is countercultural and subversive, and it makes important statements about America today. Good writers want to be subversive, and they want to be on The Simpsons." Well, some writers are more subversive than others. While the Times article describes undergrounders Franzen, Wolf, and Chabon as being absolutely ecstatic to be on the show, Gore Vidal tells the Times reporter he's never seen it before. "I live in Italy," he explained. And that's the news for the 1st of December 2005. I'm Dennis Johnson.
It's December 1st. And on this day in literary history, Melville House author Arthur Conan Doyle published his first tale starring the great sleuth Sherlock Holmes. A Study in Scarlet appeared in the Beaton's Christmas Annual in 1887 and introduced the morphine-addicted detective and his sidekick, Dr. Watson, to wild success, spawning perhaps the most popular fictional character ever created. Today is also the day that saw the birth of Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, when the first installment appeared in the magazine All the Year Round in 1860. Containing some of Dickens' finest writing, the story began, quote, "Hold your noise," cried a terrible voice as a man started up from among the graves at the side of the church porch. "Keep still, you little devil, or I'll cut your throat." From that thundering beginning, unrolled Dickens' massive novel that was serialized in the magazine over the course of 2 years. Dickens, at the time, was editor of All the Year Round. December 1st is also the day that another major writer missed his deadline. Victor Hugo was supposed to deliver the finished manuscript of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, according to the agreement that he had with his publisher. But he was busy with his play Hernani, that touched off a bitter and protracted debate between French classicists and the Romantics, himself among them. It was then that he wrote, "Romanticism is the liberalism of literature." But finally, to his publisher's great relief, he finished The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and it was published to great acclaim in 1831. I'm Valerie Merriens, and that's this day in literary history.
I know my chicken. You got to know your chicken.
I'm George Murray from BookNinja.com with the Moby Lives Canadian Report. Ladies and gentlemen, you are now on Canadian soil. Please leave all guns, Krispy Kreme donuts, and far-right politicians at the border. Relax! Well, the end is coming. The end of the year, I mean, though I don't rule out the latter. And that means the coming of best of and top 100 lists. So it is in this spirit of giving and collecting advertising dollars that Canada's national newspaper, The Globe and Mail, has released its Globe 100, a list of the 100 most positively reviewed pieces from the last year. Included in this year's international fiction list are no-brainers such as Banville, Barnes, Kitsea, Cunningham, and Hornby, but But the Canadian list has some interesting choices next to the expected breadwinners like Lisa Moore, Joseph Boyd, and Charlotte Gill, and Camilla Gibb. Tomas Dobizy's Last Notes, Golda Fried's Nelcott Is My Darling, and Stephen Hyten's Afterlands all appeared as well. Now, Hyten's no slouch, but I wouldn't say he's expected. In the nonfiction section, there's also quite a range of titles, from The Molly Fire by Michael Mitchell to The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion, and to Neil Young Nation by Canadian ingenue Kevin Chong. And God bless books editors, they even found room for three poetry titles, including Modern and Normal by Karen Soley, reviewed by, well, some hack from Toronto. The book section does full reviews of about 750 titles a year. Partials pop out at over 1,500. So winnowing down the list of positive reviews to a manageable number is surely a monumental task. Regarding the exclusivity of the list, book section editor Martin Levin writes in a parallel column that choosing the books really wasn't up to him. In all this, the views of your editors don't count for much. I can think of several instances of trusted reviewer producing a glowing notice of a novel that I felt like flinging against a wall. On the other hand, some books I've liked enormously have been roughly treated. Too bad, they're out. I think we all know what book he's talking about here. Yours. Presumably making next year's choice even more difficult will be a brand new Daily Books column by John Alamang, just launched at the Globe this week. Now, I may have misread things, but a Daily Books column? I'm hoping Alamang either got a good long head start, or he's childless. In related news, the Literary Review of Canada, or LRC, has released its list of the top 100 Canadian books of all time. Given LRC's scintillating reputation as the C-SPAN of Can Lit, one would expect all kinds of wild and crazy choices, and one would not be disappointed. Sorry, that was just me choking on my own boredom. Now included are such titles as 1839's Report on the Affairs of British North America by Lord Durham, 1863's Potboiler Geological Survey of Canada, Report of Progress from its Commencement to 1863, and the 1985 bestseller, Report on the Economic Union and Development Prospects for Canada by the Macdonald Commission. And though time is short, please indulge me in one more title, a personal favorite of mine that I suggest you all run out and pick up, the 1946 classic Report of the Royal Commission to Investigate the Facts Relating to and the Circumstances Surrounding the Communication by Public Officials and Other Persons of Positions of Trust of the Secret and Confidential Information to Agents of a Foreign Power. I believe that last one was written by Tom Clancy, yeah. The National Post, Canada's paper of right-wing ideas and SUV ads, never one to be left behind except, you know, in sales, has released its own list, but there's no one in front of the two zeros. That's right, having cut its book review section a few years ago in favor of pursuits more congruent with the eastern end of the political spectrum, the National Post this year brings us the Post OO. Obviously a fiscally wise move cutting that book section there, boys and girls. Here's hoping you survive the year. So that's it for me. Until next time, I have one message from all of us up here in Canada to all of you. Don't be fishing our turbot there, bye. I'm George Murray from BookNinja.com.
Take the National Express when your life's in a mess. It'll make you smile. All human life is here, from the feeble old deer to the screaming.
I've got Erica Berla on the line from this Italian sub-agent, Ali. Erica, tell me, what's the most popular book in Italy right now?
The most popular book is by Dan Brown. Both the Dan Brown thrillers are the best-selling novels at the moment in Italy, as in most European countries, I believe.
Well, what would you say is the most popular book written by an Italian right now?
At the moment, at the top of the Italian list, we have Alessandro Baricco with his new book, Questa Storia. Then we have a fiction writer called Paola Mastracola. She's published by Wanda, quite a funny, light read, very good. An important Italian author also, Claudio Magris, published by Mondadori, is very popular. So we have quite a few Italian.
But nothing as popular as Dan Brown.
No. Dan Brown is the top one. Alessandro Baricco comes after that, but nothing as well-selling as Dan Brown.
And Baricco is a novelist?
Baricco is a novelist, yes. I think I do believe he's published in the U.S., but I'm not sure by whom at the moment. He writes kind of historical literary novels, quite poetic, not too upmarket.
So roughly how many books in the Italian market are works in translation versus books originally written in Italian?
Well, it's difficult to say because the statistics say that about 25% are in translation, but these statistics take into consideration all works, even university works, and so of course a lot of those are published by Italian writers. But if we think at fiction, I think it would be roughly half. I mean, sometimes about a few years ago, I think there was even more works in translation than by Italian authors, and recently there are more Italian authors writing, especially in fiction. Mm. Non-fiction, there are more Italian writers than, you know, books published than in translation.
Mm-hmm. And what other languages are read most widely by Italians?
Hardly any. Italians are very poor readers in Italian, let alone in languages. We are very bad readers in other languages, maybe a bit of English, but just university, for research. People do not read in English. Italian people do not read in other languages.
Mm. Sounds familiar. What's the most controversial book on the market in Italy today?
We have a controversial book. We would have, Bruno Vespa is not exactly controversial. He's a journalist, very popular journalist, who is very read in Italy at the moment. We have Gad Lerner is another popular journalist who has a very controversial title, which is called Tu Sei un Bastardo, which means you are a bastard, because he is a very known Jewish journalist. And he's quite provocative, so he's certainly somebody I would read if I could read Italian.
So most of the books that are controversial are in nonfiction about politics.
Yes, about politics. In the bestseller list, there is Enzo Biaggi, who is a journalist who has been censored by the Italian TV since Berlusconi has been in power. And his book is third in the list, and that's a very important book because he talks about television and how it's changed and the history, basically, as well.
So everyday people in Italy are reading books like this about Berlusconi, and it's the most popular kind of controversial thing to do?
Yes. People read about Berlusconi, people read about politics in general. People read also the American bestsellers. We have Jared Diamond in the bestseller list in the nonfiction. But politics is a popular subject, obviously.
Well, that leads me to my next question, which is, are there American authors who are popular in Italy that Americans might not expect? Someone other than Dan Brown, perhaps?
If one looks down, a bit down in the list, there are, for example, there is Paola Fox, which is doing extremely well here in Italy, selling lots of copies, and is kind of being relaunched, and she's maybe no longer in the limelight for you, no, in the States.
Fazzi
publisher is a small Italian, an independent Italian company based in Rome, and they're doing very well in relaunching American titles, which maybe in the States don't sell as well, but here sell extremely well. And Paola Fox and all, you know, Desperate Characters sold more than 30,000 copies, and now they've relaunched all her paperbacks. And she's comes like ranks 20 in the bestseller of foreign fiction, and that's somebody maybe you wouldn't expect, I think.
Why do you think that's so successful now in Italy?
Because in Italy we are rereading good quality literature, and some publishers manage to get the right word of mouth, and it's and she writes very well. I think there are some more classical writers that are being discovered again.
Mm-hmm. Well, what living Italian author would you encourage Americans to read?
We're all a bit critical of Italian authors, a bit disappointed of the living ones. I mean, I mentioned already Claudio Magris, who is a very erudite and very erudite writer, maybe a bit difficult, but definitely very respectable. There is another writer who's translated in the U.S., Andrea Camilleri. He writes crime, literary crime, and he's interesting because he's one of the most sold writers abroad. But if I had to suggest somebody to read something that I think really is worthwhile culturally, it's not a living writer. It's Elsa Morante, who is one of the most important writers in Italian literature and very readable, like the French classics. I mean, she wrote two beautiful novels. One is called La Storia, which I think is translated as History, The History, and the other one is Arturo's Island. And they are amazing, wonderful stories with a very interesting backdrop of the Italian social history. I mean, based in the 20th century, obviously. So I really would recommend people to read Elsa Morante's works. I think they're published by Steerforth Press.
Great. Thank you so much, Erica.
James Marcus is on the line. His book Amazonia has just come out in paperback. This was initially published last year by the New Press. The paperback version is from the New Press as well. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What has transpired since the initial release of the book? I noticed that the paperback version has a new afterword commentary from you. Maybe you could tell our listeners what you summarize since the book's first release in that
well,
afterword.
Sure. The afterword is really in two pieces. The first part of it is about what's happened to Amazon since I completed the manuscript in the first place, which, given the company's hyperactive way of life, it was actually quite a lot. And then the second half of it was really about critical response to the book, but also more directly Amazon's own response to the book. You don't always get to have a corporate subject react positively or negatively to what you do, but since Amazon is in the business of selling books, that issue was bound to come up.
So how did they respond?
Well, you know, even before I had finished the manuscript, there was some discussion with my editor at the New Press about, you know, how actionable the book might be, how grumpy Amazon might be when it came out. So there was actually an initiative to send the manuscript to Jeff Bezos directly as soon as it was completed. Mm-hmm. The idea being that if there was going to be any litigation, it would be better to nip it in the bud.
Now, you were fairly friendly with Bezos just from the working situation, so there was a good chance that he might actually read this and respond.
I thought so. I mean, you know, I can't. I wasn't his, you know, bunk mate at summer camp, but all of my dealings with him were pretty amiable. Mm-hmm. And given that the book is not, you know, an axe grinding vituperative attack on the company, but I think a fairly bemused, more in sorrow than in anger, mm-hmm. recollection, mm-hmm. I thought he might actually enjoy it and find it entertaining. Mm-hmm. So I sent it directly to him. I never did hear from him, but I knew the book had arrived because it was passed on to the legal department, and from there made its way into the hands of some of the dramatis personae in the book. So I knew that it had showed up, and there was no sort of barking, yapping response. So we assumed that in this case, silence was golden.
And so the book, the publication went forward, and then did you hear from Amazon after that?
Well, the publication went forward, and that was all fine. And in fact, as I recount in the afterword, there was originally this idea that Amazon would in fact have a little reception for me when I went to Seattle as part of my two-city author tour. I had initially, you know, said to the New Press, look, Amazon doesn't do these sort of author party things because there's not a store to do it in, and it's just not their custom. But they did, in fact, have conversations, and there was this wine and cheese event planned, and I was actually sort of excited about it, the idea of making my prodigal son return. But the day before I was supposed to leave, or a day or so, I got a call from the New Press, and in fact, my wine and cheese party had been canceled. And according to the Amazon spokesperson, it was because, according to corporate regulation, Amazon could not give a party for someone who had written a book about Amazon. So
That's a pretty particular rule.
Yeah, it may have been, you know, the ink may still have been wet on that one. But, you know, in any case, that was okay because Amazon was certainly happy to sell the book. And in fact, they sold more of it than anybody else. The independent booksellers were kind of a close second, but I think there may have been some reservations that got in the way of my little party, but basically they were happy to sell it, and, you know, that meant a positive response.
Now, as you say, your book is not particularly vindictive. It seems like a fair accounting of the ups and downs of the rise of Amazon. Or as the subtitle of the book puts it, 5 years at the epicenter of the dot-com juggernaut. But you did hear, as I read in the book, the afterword, you did hear from many of the people you talked about besides Jeff Bezos. How did they respond in general to the book?
Generally, they responded just fine. I think, you know, doing this book was certainly an object lesson for me in what happens when you write a memoir with real names of real people in it and recount scraps of conversation you remember from 8 years ago. And and people are basically more thin-skinned than you give them credit for.
Yeah.
So there were, you know, some stray grumbles, but most of the people, I think, thought the book was pretty fair, you know, pretty fair, accurate, within the limits of everybody having a slightly different take on these things. So I think I got off without a scratch, really.
Yeah.
I did give a reading in Seattle, and I just thought, well, you know, if I leave the stage without someone throwing a, you know, a bag of urine at me, I'll know that things really worked out okay. And that's what happened.
That is one of the fundamental definitions of a good reading.
That's a threshold for me.
Did people from Amazon come to that event?
Oh, yeah. No, in fact, right before the event, there was kind of a reunion of many of my, you know, old editorial colleagues, some of whom hadn't seen each other in a while. And then, you know, we all trooped over there, at which point I saw other people, and I think some people who still work there. And I just think they found it sort of entertaining, really. Certainly, I didn't get any hostility from the audience there.
Well, one of the more interesting follow-ups to the book is included in the new paperback edition, which is an interview. I'm not sure if you're interviewing him or he's interviewing you, with Henry Blodgett. Henry Blodgett, to remind our listeners, is the, what would you call him, James? The financial...
I'd call him an ex-financial analyst at this point. And now he's essentially a journalist.
Okay, but at the time he was one of the leading financial analysts on Wall Street of the dot-com boom. And he was the man who said that when Amazon went public, their stock would go to, what was it, $400?
$400 was his famous target, yes.
Which it promptly did.
Yeah.
And he's since had his downfall, sorry to say, but there he is looking back with you on in an interview conducted here in New York at the Housing Works Bookstore Cafe. What was that like to meet up with him? That was the first meeting, I take it?
Yeah, that was the first meeting. And again, there was a, you know, little bit of nervousness because he does figure in the book. I mean, not as someone I ever met, but as someone who certainly, you know, helped to inflate the bubble. I should point out that Blodgett did eventually get in trouble over some of his calls and is, you know, no longer allowed to be a securities analyst, essentially. But it was not his, those were not his Amazon calls that created difficulties for him. And
his Amazon calls turned out to be very accurate.
They did actually turn out to be accurate. And, you know, you can always debate, there's a certain chicken and egg ambiguity there, but it takes more than one person to create a gigantic financial bubble. And I think Blodgett, you know, was shrewd enough to see that Amazon was going to be a very big deal. Now, since his sort of banishment from the securities industry, he has written for Slate, I think sometimes for the New York Times, and for other publications, and he also has an outfit called Cherry Hill Research, which I think is a one-man band, and, you know, he sort of issues position papers, and there's a website. But, you know, his head does pop up in the book, and I didn't know what he would think of the way he was treated. But when I met him, I have to say he was, you know, very easy to talk to, obviously very smart, very funny, and we had, as you said, it was kind of a conversation, wasn't so much an interview.
Right. Well, I should fill in readers who, or listeners who haven't read the book, that one of the more poignant aspects of the book is the younger James following the Amazon stock, as was everyone at the place, which seemed to be peopled by kind of starving artist types and intellectuals who were suddenly in the position of having stock and seeing it climb and climb and climb and then fall and fall and fall. And it's a very poignant continuing theme in the book, and here is Blodgett, who kind of represents all that on the public stage with you.
Yeah.
It must have been, it gives me goosebumps thinking about it. It must have been a poignant moment for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's true in the sense that he was, you know, one of the engineers of the whole thing, or at least an engineer of the public perception of what was going on. But, you know, I have my own mixed feelings about being showered with wealth and then having quite a lot of that wealth boil away when the bubble collapsed. But it's not as though I held him responsible for it.
No.
And, you know, there was something unreal and otherworldly about that whole aspect of working at a place like Amazon. And, you know, it's one thing to work at a company where one of your colleagues wins the lottery, but it's another one to work at one where everyone has won the lottery all at the same time. So it made for a certain, you know, at least temporary detachment from reality, but I'm back in it now, and I believe Henry Blodgett is back in it now as well. And, you know, mainly he tried to put the book in the context of previous boom and bust cycles and of, you know, the you know, stock market of the 1920s leading up to the crash of 29, because he's definitely a student of these things, and he definitely sees the dot-com, you know, inflation and deflation as a classic piece of a, you know, of a bigger pattern.
Well, and he discusses as well in this interview just his reading of your book, which he seems to think was pretty perceptive.
I think he liked it. I mean, he had some, he said somewhere in there that, you know, I believe he said, sometimes I'm treated favorably, sometimes not so favorably.
Yes.
And I mean, I don't really think I knocked him around at all. I did. I had come across the fact that he was, had been a frustrated fiction writer earlier in his life.
Right.
And I thought that was an interesting fact to put alongside of the, you know, fictional seeming miracles, economic miracles of the day. But
if it was fiction, you wouldn't have believed it, perhaps.
No, it would have seemed, you know, flimsy and contrived. But
he makes an observation that I found interesting. Was he did talk about the original stock market crash of 1929 and note that there were no real insider accounts of that cataclysmic event on world affairs, and he puts Amazonia in that perspective by saying that this is a different instance where we have a similarly important financial catastrophe, and yet we now have reports about the buildup, and that was an interesting perspective for your book.
That's what he really liked about the book, and that's what sort of really pleased me about the conversation. You know, he said, look, it's painfully easy in retrospect to look at these things and say, oh my God, you know, mm-hmm. what idiots everybody was, and didn't they see what was happening? Mm-hmm. But what he liked about this book is he felt that it conveyed from the inside that sort of euphoria that was going on and made it seem, you know, understandable and human, even if in retrospect some of it seems very farcical. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, a lot of what I was trying to do. Mm-hmm. And so if he felt it was successful in that way, that was a very, you know, very pleasing thought to me.
Well, James Marcus, last question. Do you still follow the ups and downs of Amazon as closely as you used to, or is it too painful to you?
No, it's not too painful. I mean, I don't have the same emotional connection mm-hmm. to the company's fortunes as I once did. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, given how exhilarating it was to work there, I can't help but watch, at least out of the corner of my eye, you know, as the company careens this way and that. And I would guess I'll always be at least a wee bit curious about what's going on at, you know, Uncle Jeff's Playhouse.
Well, understandable. You were there from the beginning. Well, perhaps we can have you back on the show. I hope you'll come back on the show to talk about some of those developments from your unique perspective. In the meantime, the book is Amazonia, 5 years at the epicenter of the dot-com juggernaut from the New Press. James Marcus, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Anytime, Dennis.
Okay.
And that's our show for the first day of December 2005. Thanks to James Marcus in New York, to George Murray in Toronto, and to Erica Berla in Italy for coming on the show. And by the way, if you didn't catch those books that Erica recommended, they were History and Arturo's Island, both by Elsa Morante, Morante, both available from Steerforth Press. Thanks to our engineer, Andrew Steinmetz, and everyone at Melville House, Kelly Burdick, Becky Kramer, and publisher Valerie Marians. Come on back tomorrow. We're going to be talking to our UK correspondent, Mark Thwaite of Ready Steady Book. And we're also going to be talking to publisher Doug Seibold about returns. Can't live with them. Can't live with them. Well, a fact of life, perhaps, but so too is this. That whale is out there, man.
Io mi aspettavo, sai da te, una risposta come il fu, e invece niente, invece no, un pugno in faccia era meglio, lo so. Io mi aspettavo, sai da te, qualcosa in più, qualcosa che non fosse una banalità, non fosse il solito scontato bla bla, ti faccio i complimenti e ti lascio con i tuoi gne 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 avevi tutto per piacere. Gambe sottili, un bel sedere, d'occhioni azzurri quasi blu, un seno enorme, un viso d'angelo tu, in ogni ambiente un figurone, sorrisi, invidia, profusione, ma che fortuna quello lì, portarsi a letto una stangona così, ma la conversazione in me si riduceva dei gne 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 gne. Ti ho poi rivista alla TV, 10 anni dopo forse di più, un calendario sopra tu, solite pose, un cliché del ravù, ci dica che progetti ha, posare nuda, ma perché, è stato imbarazzante o no, all'orizzonte un fidanzato ora c'è,
una studiata pausa e lo hai seppellito di gne 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 g